From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. It is ironic that our nation's capital is an exception when it comes to voting rights and elected representatives. It is also ironic that government officials based in Washington, D.C. are largely white, while D.C. itself and especially surrounding neighborhoods and cities are dominated by African Americans. There is a rich history around race, colonization, slavery, and freedom in D.C., and that history has been told in a powerful new book called Chocolate City, A History of Race and Democracy in the Nation's Capital. My guest is Chris Myers-Ash. He is the editor of Washington History. He also teaches history at Colby College, and he's the co-author with George Derek Musgrove of Chocolate City. Welcome to the program, Chris.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, we rarely think about specifically Washington, D.C. when we think about the country's origins, when we talk about colonization and the violence against Native American communities, slavery, et cetera. We might talk about it as a whole and the nation as a whole, or we might talk about the South. But specifically, Washington, D.C., where our nation's capital resides, has its own very fascinating history. Let's start with Native Americans and Captain John Smith, and how the history in Washington, D.C., of the clash between the indigenous occupants of the area we now know as Washington, D.C. today and the arriving colonizers set the tone for what came about even later and what had already been happening around the rest of the country.
Sure. It's the opening of the book, of course, begins with that encounter between early European settlers and the Native American tribes, particularly a tribe called the Nakostin, that were living in the land that would become Washington, D.C. And of course, today in D.C., people talk about gentrification and the displacement of low-income people. And if you want to talk about displacement in D.C., you should really go all the way back to the Nakostin, who were there first on the land. And they dominated the land. They were part of a confederacy of Native American tribes when the first Europeans arrived in the 17th century. And over the course of the next century of contact between wars and disease and clashes between Native Americans and the English settlers, the Nakostin were pushed further and further west off their land. But the land now occupied by Joint Base Anacostia-Bolling, which is named Anacostia, it's the only thing that remains of the Nakostin in D.C., that base sits on the land that was their primary village. But by the time the federal government is being built and the capital city is being built for the United States of America, the Nakostin have been pushed further and further west until they disappear from the historical record by the late 18th century.
How does the geography of what we know as Washington, D.C. today have its roots in some of that history as well?
It's interesting. Of course, you know, our president promised to, quote, drain the swamp, and people love to talk about how D.C. was built on a swamp. But in fact, it was rich plantation country, and it was chosen predominantly because it was rich plantation country, and there was a fully operational slave society on that land in the 1700s when the founders of this country decided to place the capital of the new United States on the Potomac River. It was chosen because it was in the South. Many Virginian leaders in particular, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, James Madison, they did not want the new capital to be in Philadelphia or anywhere north of the Mason-Dixon line because they feared the growing anti-slavery movement, which was small at the time, but they worried about putting the capital in a cosmopolitan place. And so instead they chose for it to be on the banks of the Potomac in between two of the largest slave states in the country, and so that they could have more control, so that it would be a slave city from the beginning. And it was. We often don't remember, but D.C. Was a slave city. It was a southern city up until the Civil War.
And amazing that you refer to it as a southern city. And I want to quote from your book about this because this is so crucial. You say, you write in your book, Chocolate City, that it was a fully functioning slave society, a land dotted with tobacco plantations owned by powerful slaveholding families. Slavery and the aristocratic political lifestyle that accompanied it defined life in the fields of southern Maryland and northern Virginia that became the national seat of government. The city that grew atop those fields incorporated slavery into every aspect of life. So describe what that time was like and how it was very much part of, even though of course the history that came later on defied that, but how it was very much part of the Southern legacy of slavery.
Absolutely. So enslaved people were central to the building of the city. George Washington chooses the site in 1790, and for the next 10 years, enslaved workers are used basically as a bargaining chip to control white laborers.
And in fact, is that why the cover of your book is what it is? If you can maybe describe that also visually
sure,
for our radio audience.
Absolutely. The cover of the book shows what appears to be the United States Capitol building. Of course, it's right in the center of downtown Washington. But if you look closely, the columns of that building are actually African-Americans struggling to hold it up. And their struggle, part of our overall argument, part of the reason we call it Chocolate City is that their struggle, the struggle of the African American population in Washington is central to the culture and politics of DC. It's also central to the culture and politics of this nation.
Right.
And so this is embedded in from the very beginning. Enslaved people built the Capitol, they built the White House, they built the city, and as I mentioned before, you know, in 1800, when the federal government moves to Washington, enslaved people are 30% of the population. And so we call the book Chocolate City in part because the presence of this large African-American population was central to the development of D.C. as a city.
Right. It's not that it's today dominated by African-Americans because people necessarily moved in. I mean, although I'm sure there have been waves of movements, but right from the start, there were African-Americans in that city. There were enslaved African-Americans in that city.
Absolutely. You know, the enslaved people waited on the leaders of the country. They worked in the White House. 8 of the first 12 presidents brought slaves with them to serve them in the White House. And so D.C. for a time in the 1830s was actually the largest slave trading city in the United States of America. And because what was happening is the soils of Northern Virginia and Southern Maryland were being depleted after a couple centuries of tobacco farming, many slave owners were selling their slaves down south, and they would go to D.C. They'd actually go to Alexandria, which is now in Virginia, but up until the 1840s, it was part of Washington, D.C. So they would go to D.C., go to the slave traders there on the banks of the Potomac, and sell their quote-unquote property down south. And so D.C. was the largest slave trading city in the country. But it was also the site of a large free black community that grew over time, so that by the 1830s, even as so many slaves are being shipped south, the majority of black people in Washington are free, and they're building their own schools, they're building their own churches, they're building their own community institutions, and they're also part of a strong and sometimes public abolitionist movement. And so black people in D.C. often team up sometimes with white political leaders from the north to rescue enslaved people, ferry them up north. The largest attempted slave escape in the history of America was attempted out of Washington, D.C.
Wow.
When 77 slaves tried to make their way up to Philadelphia. They unfortunately were caught, but they tried to escape on a ship called the Pearl. And this presence of both an enslaved community, but also a growing and strong free black community is really important to the history of the city.
Let's actually go a little bit further back, though, in terms of the timeline of slavery and the sort of founding fathers, if you will. What was that That clash? What did that clash look like? And even maybe share with us a little bit of the timeline in terms of DC being established as the nation's capital after the writing of the Constitution. How, you know, were those very obvious contradictions with the idea of democracy and slavery fodder for debate, dialogue, clashes?
Absolutely. So it's interesting because in the Revolutionary War period, the founders, even the slave-only founders, folks like Washington and Madison, even Jefferson, they had moral qualms about slavery. You know, this idea that oh, being anti-slavery is a modern idea, and that, you know, folks back then just didn't think anything about it, is just wrong in their writings, in their letters, in their comments, particularly behind closed doors. They talk about this tension. They know that there's a tension between fighting for liberty on the one hand for this new country called America, while at the same time holding people in bondage. And there was a sense among that revolutionary generation that slavery would eventually die out. And I think it was wishful thinking, perhaps, because it was so deeply embedded in the Southern economy. But there was a sense that they didn't really have to do anything to end slavery because slavery was kind of an anachronistic institution. Events, of course, proved them wrong, because in the early 1800s, with the invention of the cotton gin, slavery booms. And so even after the transatlantic slave trade is ended in 1808, slavery just explodes across what we now call the Deep South. And so slavery becomes even more deeply embedded into the Southern economy and more a part of Southern life. And so as you go further along in the early decades of the 19th century, what you get is actually a whole new movement saying that slavery is a positive good as opposed to a moribund institution. What's interesting is in Washington, though, in DC has always been a cosmopolitan city, right? We have foreign observers who come here, diplomats who come to visit and stay in the city. And they're often quite puzzled and disturbed by the presence of slavery, slave auctions going on within sight of the Capitol, slave pens within sight of the Capitol, slave coffles, you know, chains of slave fa enslaved families walking within sight of these palaces to American freedom. And they would comment upon this contradiction. And people knew it was a contradiction. And so what you start to see in the early decades, especially in the 1810s, you start to see the beginnings of a domestic anti-slavery movement, and they put DC in the crosshairs. DC becomes the primary target. William Lloyd Garrison, who was a white abolitionist, said that DC was the first citadel to be carried by the abolitionist movement because it was so symbolic. It was symbolic of all of America. And so
Right.
we had to remove this sin from the city. What's interesting is DC also becomes the center of what was called the colonization movement, which is different than the colonizers of the, you know, of English settlers a century before. What the colonization movement wanted to do was to take free black people and colonize them back in Africa, send them back to Africa, essentially. This is where the country of Liberia was started by American philanthropists and American, you know, these were white Americans who thought they were very enlightened on the race issue. And their solution to the race problem was, let's just get rid of the black people, right? Well, so they felt bad about having slaves because they knew it was a contradiction to American ideals, but they weren't willing to grant African Americans political equality or any kind of equality. So they said, well, the solution is we'll just send them back to Africa. And they did by the thousands in the 1820s and 30s. And DC
Wow.
was the center of the colonization movement. And again, people who supported colonization often thought of themselves as being racially liberal. Men like
Wow.
Francis Scott Key, who wrote the national anthem, he is the district of attorney of Washington. He's ubiquitous. He lives in Georgetown. He owns slaves himself at a plantation in Maryland. He considers himself a very Christian, very pious slaveholder who has the enslaved people's best interests at heart. And his solution is to colonize people, to send them back to Africa.
Chris, you write in your book, Chocolate City, about many interesting individuals that we've never really heard of before, or if we're outside DC, we haven't heard of them. You write about enslaved people like Anne Williams. Tell us about Anne Williams, who she was, and how her story is part of this fabric of DC's history.
Absolutely. So Anne Williams was an enslaved woman living on a plantation right outside the Washington border. And she is picked up one day by a slave trader and brought into the city to be sold with her daughters. And she knows what this means. She knows that this means being torn away from her family, never seeing her husband again, never, you know, basically upending everything. And she doesn't want to do it. And so she flings herself from a third story window where
she's being
held.
You have this dramatic image in your book of that, mm-hmm. a sort of painting depicting that.
Absolutely. So she winds up, she falls, crashes onto the street. She breaks her legs and crushes her spine. She's terribly injured. The slave trader no longer wants her. So that the tavern keeper, the owner of the inn where she was being kept, basically keeps her as his slave. But she grants an interview to this young white doctor who comes to town, who is observing slavery and it has some anti-slavery sentiment. And he's appalled by her, by what happened to her and the story of her fall and what's happened to her and the existence of slavery in this supposed citadel of freedom. And so he writes in 1817 a book called A Portraiture of Domestic Slavery, which is one of the first anti-slavery tracts. And it's really the first one that places Washington in the center of this debate, because he says, as later abolitionists will say over and over, that Washington must not have slavery. We must end the slave trade and we must end slavery in Washington because it is incompatible with the freedom that we're supposed to that we profess around the world. And so Anne really Williams and her desperate leap for freedom really becomes a catalyst for the anti-slavery movement that ultimately ends up winning a ban on the slave trade in the Compromise of 1850 and eventually winning emancipation for Washington slaves in April 1862, 8 months before the Emancipation Proclamation.
And of course, this is such a remarkable history that you know, ought to be better known. There's another figure you write about, Benjamin Banneker. Who is he?
So Benjamin Banneker is he's an African American, a self-taught astronomer. He is as a farmer, and he helps Andrew Ellicott with the original survey of the 10-mile square that would become Washington. I mean, if you look at the map today, it doesn't look much like a square or a diamond, but it used to be 10 miles on either side of the Potomac. And Benjamin Banneker and Andrew Ellicott drew up the original survey. You know, he didn't do any of the physical labor. He was in the tents and working on the surveys and also staying up at night to watch the stars. He also produced an almanac. And he sent this almanac. So this is during this is in 1790, 1791, and he produces this fabulous almanac, and he sends it to Thomas Jefferson with a little note, basically calling Jefferson out, saying, "Look, you call yourself this man of freedom. You wrote the Declaration of Independence. Why can't you extend that freedom to us, to African Americans?" And he used the almanac as evidence that African Americans were fully capable of excelling and being contributing citizens to the country. And this exchange is really interesting because Jefferson tries to argue that, you know, Benjamin Banneker, I admit this is a great almanac, but it's just because he himself is extraordinary. And Banneker wants nothing of it. He says, no, it's not because I'm extraordinary. It's because I've had opportunity. And any enslaved person, any African American who has opportunity could also excel. So it's an extraordinary exchange between one of the founding, you know, leading thinkers of the country and this self-taught black astronomer who's really challenging him on the fundamental questions that drove the American Revolution and that continue to animate this country today.
And today you can actually sit in Benjamin Banneker Park.
You can. Not many
in
people go
DC.
there because it's kind of lost in this array of highways and exit ramps that is Southwest DC. But you can. It's a little oasis of green.
And you write in your book that it was the first park, federal park, to be named for a black person. Pretty remarkable.
Not until the 1970s did that happen.
So going back to what you were saying about Washington, D.C. at a time being the sort of center of the slave trade, but also this place where enslaved African Americans and free blacks, were in the same city. How did that then lead to it be also becoming a center of abolition, and African Americans beginning their journey to lay claim to the city that they had built?
It's a great question, and it's interesting because the free black community was not separated from the enslaved black community. They were often related, right? You had family members who some were enslaved and some were free. You had this remarkable woman, Alethea Tanner, who buys her own freedom, has a vegetable stand, buys her own freedom, and then spends the next 3 decades going selling her vegetables, saving up money, and buying 26 of her family members out of slavery.
Wow,
And
that
so
is
they're
remarkable.
it's extraordinary. And one of her nephews, a man named John Cook, then goes on to establish a school, a private school for African Americans, a debating society, becomes a leading abolitionist in the city. And so you have black intellectuals who are making the argument that slavery is wrong, and particularly slavery is wrong in Washington, D.C. And the reason why abolitionists and African Americans in the city really target D.C. is not only because it's a symbol of America and therefore should symbolize freedom and not slavery, but also because there is no real democracy, no self-government in D.C. Although there is an elected city government, that's ultimately ruled by Congress. Congress has veto power over anything. And so if it wanted to, Congress could end D.C. and slavery in D.C. right away. And the abolitionists knew that. So they didn't have to go through the state government in Mississippi or in North Carolina to end slavery. Congress could do it right away, automatically. And so they pushed members of Congress to abolish slavery and the slave trade in Washington. And African Americans, local African Americans, were leading that effort. They were challenging the black codes that the city government was trying to impose on the black community. They fought in court. They used the Underground Railroad. They partnered with white abolitionists to buy people out of freedom, out of slavery to freedom. So they worked in many different ways to challenge slavery from within.
What about the origin of the controversy over voting rights in Washington, D.C., or really lack thereof? If you are a U.S. citizen living in Washington, D.C. today, you have very limited representation, ironically, of course. Does that have roots in the fact that D.C. has always been a chocolate city?
It does. It's interesting. From the very beginning, there were complaints among the white residents of the town that they did not have representation in Congress. And this happens early on. The Congress strips DC of the right to vote and asserts essentially exclusive control over the city. And there are complaints from the very beginning. And so Congress then sets up an elected city government in the early 1800s with a mayor and city council and so forth. And this exists right up into Reconstruction. So after the Civil War, again, DC. The enslaved people of DC are the first ones to be emancipated. This becomes a point of pride for Washington, the black community in Washington, to be what they call the first freed. And DC, for a time in the 1860s, really becomes this remarkable experiment in interracial democracy. And so you have leading black politicians and intellectuals moving to DC in order to take part in this experiment in biracial democracy. And so black voters, white voters join together. They vote in a white abolitionist as mayor in 1868. The city council passes a whole wave of anti-discrimination laws in 1869 and the early 1870s. And really the success of this interracial democratic movement triggers a counter-revolution among white businessmen and other elites in town who never really trusted democracy at all, let alone biracial democracy. And so they helped convince Congress to basically do a two-step retreat from democracy. In 1871, Congress creates what's called a territorial government, which centralizes power in an unelected board of public works. And then 3 years later, strips all DC residents, white and black, of the right to vote entirely. And so for a whole century, there was not even any self-government in Washington. There was no city council, there were no votes. The city was run by a three-man, and it was all men, three commissioners who ran the city by themselves. They were presidentially appointed. And so there was no democracy whatsoever. And a large part was a reaction to the black political power that was exercised during Reconstruction.
Right. There's so much more to talk about in your book. We could spend hours discussing it. It's a hefty book, more than 500 pages long. So I want to skip ahead in the last few minutes of our conversation to the fact that, of course, Washington, D.C. became and still continues today because of the fact that it houses our Capitol and White House and et cetera, and the seat of government has become the focus of national political movements for social justice. And very specifically and interestingly, the March on Jobs and for Jobs in Washington, led by the civil rights movement and notably Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., that you open your book with, finds its way to, finds itself in the middle of a city with this incredible history that we've just been discussing. Was that a really pivotal moment for Washington, D.C.? Obviously, a lot of people came into the city from outside. But for the city's residents, was that really crucial?
It's interesting. We do open the book with that scene, in part to show how divorced Washingtons were from this larger conversation about democracy. They didn't even have any of these things that King was talking about. So it's really not a watershed moment for the city. Much of what the civil rights movement was still struggling to achieve in the South in 1963. D.C. had achieved 10 years before. The civil rights movement in D.C. was remarkably successful in the early years after the World War II, and really with the rise of the Cold War, because what civil rights activists do is they use the language of the Cold War. You know, Washington is we called it the capital of the free world, right? And America was fighting this Cold War for freedom against the totalitarians of the Soviet Union. But of course, in our very own capital city, there was racial segregation and discrimination. And so post-World War II, there's a really strong interracial movement that systematically cuts away at the foundation of segregation and discrimination in the city. And so by the time of 1954, with Brown versus Board of Education, which in D.C. it was called Bowling v. Sharp, that was the case that affected D.C. D.C. is largely desegregated. But what happens is that there's very little change in the lives, particularly of poor black Washingtonians. So by the time King comes in the early 1960s, by the time of the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, in the mid-1960s, these major legal triumphs in the South, in the civil rights movement, people in D.C. are looking around and saying, look, we've achieved this, right? We did this 10 years ago, but the situation hasn't changed, right? The situation in Washington hasn't changed much. And so this generates this era of really dynamic civic action on the ground in Washington in the late 60s and early 1970s to demand what we call home rule, right? The basic self-government for Washington. This becomes part of the local civil rights struggle. But also to challenge the rulers of the city, to challenge Congress and to redefine this relationship between Congress and its capital city, to say, this city belongs to us, right? This is our city, and you can't just do with it what you want to. The story we love to tell from that era is about the freeways. You know, it's not the sexiest protest movement, perhaps, But it's tremendously important in Washington because it showed this new relationship, because Congress basically wanted to pave over Washington. You know, freeways were the wave of the future. You had congressmen doling out pork to contractors. You had people in the press talking about how this was going to be great. We're going to funnel suburban shoppers back into the city. And so they were basically going to create these massive highways within the city, within the city limits. And then arterial, then these spoke highways that would then connect these massive highways. And so they had it all gridded out. These basically many of the neighborhoods that we love now in DC would have been completely destroyed. And a citizen movement rose up against it. And it was completely unlikely, right? They didn't have any rights to vote. And yet they created this cross-class interracial coalition with people from all across the city. An older, bald, white guy named Sammy Abbott teaming up with this young Black Power, Black nationalist named Reginald Booker. And they led this movement to stop the freeways in their tracks. And they succeeded, even without the right to vote. Just through the power of collective action and organized resistance.
Wow. Well, Chris, as I mentioned, much more to discuss. People will just have to get a copy of your book to know more about the history of our nation's capital. Thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck to you and your co-author.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much, Sanal.
Chris Myers-Ash is the editor of Washington History. He teaches history at Colby College. We've been discussing the book he's co-authored with George Derek Musgrove. It's called Chocolate City, A History of Race and Democracy in the Nation's Capital. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.